Well, good morning. It's so great to be with you this morning. I've been here before, enjoyed every time that I'm here. I'm just always overwhelmed by the graciousness and the warmth and the hospitality that I see and that I experience. And I will say, it's amazing, always such a joy to be here to talk about the way that God moves in the lives of people who are so resistant to Him. I think it's just such a message of encouragement, of hope, to really hear about people who were so far away, who are now passionate followers of Christ. And so that's my passion, and that's the point of my podcast. I just bring people on who were former atheists and skeptics, and they tell their stories of rejecting God, of becoming open to God, and then becoming passionate followers of Christ. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of glimpse of that this morning. But before we get started, I'm just curious as to you. Do any of you personally know a skeptic or atheist in your life? All right. Okay, that's a good number of you. And do any of you, or were any of you personally skeptics or atheists before you came to Christ? Oliver? A few. Yeah. Yeah, well, there are more and more these days, right? Skepticism in our culture is increasing. Skepticism of God, of Christianity, of the Bible, of Christians, it's becoming more and more common every day. We're living in a time where Christianity no longer seems plausible or attractive. More than that, it seems offensive, intolerant, and often even dangerous. Perhaps skeptics don't know exactly what Christianity is, or maybe they do, but they just know that it's not good, or that it's not really true, or that it doesn't really matter, and they, for whatever reason, don't want any part of it. Seems like many are willing to embrace anything but Christianity, and they dismiss it out of hand without any serious consideration. It's just canceled. Do I hear some feedback? Am I ringing here? I don't know what I can do to help with that. If you know someone who's skeptical of faith, it can be very disheartening and seemingly hopeless, and sometimes we think they'll never change their view. And more than that, we wonder what it would take for someone so closed off to become open to the person of Christ when they seem so resistant or angry or even apathetic. So I'm here today as someone who has listened over the past 10 years to over 100 stories of former atheists and skeptics. I really wanted to understand what it took for a skeptic to become a seeker, to become open and interested in things of God. Because this, for me, was the million-dollar question. Because once someone is willing or open to honestly search, everything seems to change. Openness seemed to be the key that unlocked the door towards conversion. So today we're going to talk about how people seemingly far away from God can become open to at least take the next step. We'll answer this question through the lives of a few former skeptics, as well as those from my podcast, as well as those from my doctoral research, which was focused on looking at the journeys of 50 former atheists and their journeys to Christ. But of course, it's only through the work of God that any heart is changed. And hopefully today we'll see some, or we'll gain some insight as to how and why they came to Christ, and that we can be encouraged that even those who are resistant can change and become open to belief. Skeptics can become seekers and even passionate followers of Christ. We'll also touch on a little bit of how we can be a part in changing their willingness to take a closer look. But first, let's start by listening in to a few former skeptics and their views of why they were closed off to faith when they were once atheists. And I want you to listen to how they characterize God. And sorry about that. I know that's bothering me. It's probably bothering you.
We don't hear.
Okay, good. Then I'll just continue. So I want you to listen to each one. They're all very different about how they're answering the question why they didn't believe in God. We'll start with Sai. You know, when you ask somebody why they don't believe in God, most often the first response you'll get is that, you know, for rational reasons, and they'll come up with something that sounds very smart.
Well, there's everything that we don't understand can be explained by science. There's no need for a God. And, you know, science disproves the supernatural. None of which is true, but that's what I thought. But once I dropped the religious part of that, which really was related to the communism, as I mentioned, I entered a phase, and I'd say this was probably when I was in college, where I was simply not, I was like today's nuns, N-O-N-E-S. I just didn't have any religion. I didn't care about it, didn't think about it.
And that's something you often hear. You know, if I believe in science, science rocks, science wins, you know. I don't need God. And you could also hear a bit of apathy there too, right, underlying it. It's just something he didn't think about. That is certainly, there are genuine intellectual doubts about God, about faith, about Christianity. Could be science. It could be, you know, problems with the Bible. It could be something with the history of Christianity. There are all kinds of genuine intellectual doubts. And that is, again, usually the first thing you'll hear from somebody when they're rejecting God. Some are very well thought out in terms of their rejection. Some not quite so much. Daniel was a young man who was raised in the UK without much religion in his life or in his world at all. Let's listen to how and why he rejected belief.
The criticism I had of belief in God, I just kind of absorbed from culture, you know, the things about, you know, the nature of the degree of suffering, you know, especially sort of human suffering and natural evil and things like that. So I could come up with objections, but I wasn't really heavily invested in them in any sort of meaningful way. I just, you know, I'd have enough to say if someone brought it up. But as I said, I think I just didn't really care, to be honest.
I guess you could think of Daniel in the same way that some people are kind of raised nominally Christian. They're kind of cultural Christians. Daniel was a cultural atheist. It was just the water that he swam in. It was just a presumption of his culture, of his friends. It's just the way that it was. You know, he had, interestingly, you know, those objections he could reach in his pocket and pull out, you know, if somebody asked him about it. But it's not something he really thought about. It's just something that he presumed. So, you know, oftentimes, when we express our beliefs in something, we give those rational reasons. But even as Blaise Pascal recognized years ago, people almost invariably arrive at their beliefs not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. So then that begs the question, well, what do you find attractive? To be honest, Christianity today and our culture today is not very attractive to the culture at large, right? There's given a lot of negative stereotyping. We're all kinds of words to describe us: intolerant, bigoted, you know, hypocritical, the list goes on. That's not something good. So sometimes people push back because they don't want it. You know, they don't believe it, but many times they just don't want it. They don't want to be one of them. Let's listen to Ashley.
So I think I just dismissed Christianity out of hand as something that was shallow. It was delusional. It was for just all the stereotypical, you know, it was for weak people, weak-minded people. It was for stupid people. So I think there was that, like, seduction, I guess, by those existentialist, kind of nihilistic writers going on at the same time.
So you hear in there, there were some intellectual reasons for her. She had read The Existentialist. She was convinced by him. But also, I am sure you heard how she characterized Christians: shallow, delusional, weak people, weak-minded, stupid people. That's not something that she wanted to be associated with. So, you know, you have the tip of the iceberg, I don't believe because for rational reasons. And then you start going deeper. They don't want it. They also don't think it's relevant. They don't need it. You know, it's not something, again, in their world like Daniel. It's just something out there. There's a lot of people who feel that way, including Mike Bird. He grew up in Australia, again, another relatively secularized country. It wasn't in his world at all.
Religion was something that other people did that I didn't need, and I didn't really understand what it was about. So it was something I hadn't given, to be honest, a lot of thought about. It was like, you know, some people like ice hockey. It was kind of like at that level, you know, that's what other people do, and I'm not other people. So it was of no interest and concern to me. And I'd only had very limited exposures to certain aspects of it or its messaging.
Of course, more and more people are having limited exposures of it as we're becoming more secularized in our nation. This is probably a more typical tale in the U.S. Pat Flynn was brought up in a nominal, well, just a limited exposure of Christianity.
We were the type of religious family that are commonly called Christers. You know, we would go to church maybe on Christmas and Easter, but it was even worse than that. We would really sort of only go to church, at least at a certain point on Christmas and Easter, when the grandparents were in town, type of thing. So it was there. It was present, but it was never seriously discussed. It wasn't something that was taken seriously. It wasn't something that was lived seriously. It seemed unimportant, and you know, so when it came to a point in my life where there seemed to be conflicts between the commitments coming from the faith, the little that I understood, and call it the wider scientific worldview, it was very much easy for me to let go of those previous religious beliefs or commitments.
Yeah, very common tale. So, you know, another narrative, science, comes along, and it's easy to dismiss religion as a delusion, as something he didn't need. You know, it was a prop that he didn't need. So, again, you don't believe it. It's not true. I don't want it. It's not good. I don't need it. It's not relevant to my life. What's interesting to me in my study with these former atheists, this last one, it's not real. He's not real. God's not real. I don't feel or see God, was the most prominent response. It was the sense that personally there couldn't be a God because of what I see, because of what I experience. That was the case for Eric. And let's listen to why he rejected God.
But things really changed as I became a teenager. And so what happened is I just started to observe the world around me a little bit. My parents were into alcohol, and that kind of made things rough growing up. And then a lot of my friends also came from pretty broken homes as well, a lot of single-parent homes. Around this time in St. Louis, there was a huge flood that got a lot of national attention. And so you see like these disasters, and then, you know, you just look at the history of the world and all these wars and pain and suffering, and looking at my own life and my friends' lives and just seeing all this pain and suffering. And that's when I began to become very skeptical of God and religion. And along the way too, I mean, you're going to school and you are hearing things like about like neo-Darwinism, and that seemed to explain human origins to me a little bit better than, you know, a couple in a garden talking to a snake or something like that. I just found I remember reading those stories as a kid and then hearing these things in my science class. And I'm not saying they had some sort of like anti-God agenda by teaching me that, but it just brought me to a conclusion that maybe science has better answers than religion. And also if God exists, it's just kind of the typical problem of evil. How could he allow all of these things to happen? So he just probably doesn't exist. And so that's how I eventually became an atheist.
I hope you're appreciating through listening to these, just a short sampling, that there are a variety of reasons why people reject God or belief in God. And it's important for us to appreciate the fact that nobody holds convictions or beliefs in a vacuum. Their convictions are wrapped in a story of how they got there and why they believe what they believe. So it's important to approach the person and all of who they are and their experiences and their perceptions and their opinions, that they're coming from some place. And we are more than rational creatures, right? And a lot of times, again, our attractions, our desires, our experiences, everything plays a part. It's not as simple sometimes as we would like to think. But nevertheless, for whatever reason, someone comes up with the idea that God does not exist or that God doesn't matter. It's very personal for them, and they usually hold to those beliefs. But sometimes it's interesting. Many times they don't come to these beliefs in a thoughtful way. Many times they think that they can hold to the benefits of a Christian worldview or the benefits of belief in God without belief, right? Because we are a westernized culture that has so much of the Christian worldview infused in it, all of our morals and values. They're just presumed. But when someone actually looks a little bit more closely at what they are accepting when they reject, you know, they know what they're rejecting. They reject God, but they don't actually sometimes know the fullness of what they're embracing in a godless worldview. Alex Rosenberg, an atheist, reminds us in a very succinct way of what that means. Does God exist? No. What is the nature of reality? He says what physics says it is. We're just particles, matter in motion, nothing more. What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? There is none. Why am I here? Luck. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? No. There's nothing after death. Is there free will? No, I make no free choices. What happens when we die? Everything goes on except us. Well, what is the difference between right and wrong? Well, there is no moral difference. Well, that's a really hard way to live, especially considering recent events. How can you not be able to call something really wrong? It's your opinion, it's your preference, but you can't call something objectively wrong or moral, immoral. Why should I be moral? Well, because it makes you feel better than being immoral. But then that begs the question, how can you be moral when you don't have a choice, if you have no free will? A lot of issues when you start looking at it closely. Does history have any meaning or purpose? It signifies nothing. And of course, the existentialists and those who understand the fullness of this worldview know that it can and does oftentimes lead to despair, because it's an empty worldview. That's what happened with Rob. He was sitting in his worldview, and it didn't feel very good.
What's the point of anything? And I became increasingly, basically, an apathetic hedonist. Those were the words I would use. My atheism was just borne out by a deep sense of apathy and hedonism. And there instinctively didn't seem to me any greater point, you know, meaning, purpose, or value in life than beyond those things.
It is a hard way to live. And those who are really thoughtful about it can find themselves in a difficult place, because the reality is, you know, we're not, in this world view, you're not, you know, infused with, you know, as a God-created being with meaning and purpose, value, satisfaction, hope for the future, all of those things that we as Christians sometimes take for granted. You're nothing in this worldview, but you must act as if things are meaningful. You must act as if, you know, there's a reason for living, that things really are good or bad, because living in a godless perspective is just difficult. Albert Camus said it this way: you must spend your life acting as if life is not absurd. Again, that's not an easy place to be. But yet, again, despite all of that, many still believe that Christianity and belief in God is not true, it's not good, it's not real, it's not relevant. In my study, again, with 50 former atheists, nearly two-thirds said that they thought they would never change from their atheism. 52%, half of them said, I wasn't satisfied in my atheism, but I soberly accepted it as truth. They couldn't see life beyond atheism. But the good statistic here is 100% of them actually became passionate followers of Christ. So there was something that broke through, something that happened in their lives that allowed them to look beyond their atheism or skepticism. And that's what I call the catalyst. That, for me, again, was the million-dollar question about what would it take for someone resistant to become open to consider, at least consider another perspective, take that first step beyond. Now, just because they become open doesn't mean that they automatically go to God. Remember, the title of this presentation is Anything But Christianity. There's a lot of baggage. And so oftentimes they'll become open, but they'll look in other directions. But this is what we're interested in. Oftentimes, if you're settled in your worldview, you're not interested in looking beyond. Typically, it takes some form of disruption in your life. Os Guinness says it this way, that in The Thinking Man's Journey, that if you're satisfied in your life, you're not going to be open. But if you come to a point of dissatisfaction, that you would be open oftentimes to look beyond. And that's what this is about, a catalyst, trying to figure something out when your own world doesn't work, own worldview doesn't work. So I identified about five primary catalysts that are disruptive events or experiences in someone's life that allows them to look open to another perspective. So what prompts seeking, disillusionment, when you have longings that are unmet, whether intellectually or in your own life, that things just don't make sense, they don't line up, they're willing to look beyond. Secondly, a destabilizing crisis. You know, something happens to you. You're not disillusioned on the inside, but something happens that's completely destabilizing for you. Third would be to disprove a challenge. Oftentimes, if they see something in Christianity or they're confronted with something about Christianity that they didn't think was there, they're often interested, but only to disprove, oftentimes is their beginning impetus, a divine encounter. Wow, that was surprising for me. I didn't expect that. Spiritual experiences occur among an unbelieving population. Of course, we see that in the third world, and we hear stories from Islam, but it actually happens in skeptics and with skeptics as well. And fifthly, and I think most importantly for us too, is a disarming experience. And that's usually with a Christian who breaks down all those negative stereotypes that they had about Christians and Christianity. So we're going to go through those quickly. The first one, again, is when someone begins to become disillusioned with their own worldview, kind of like Rob. He was sitting in a place where it wasn't good. Life wasn't good for him. But it can be an intellectual disillusionment, where they're not being able to make sense of the world within their own worldview, or an existential desire for something more than their worldview offers. Again, we are sense-making beings. We want to make sense of the world around us, what we see, and we want to make sense of the world within us. We all have those big questions: who we are, why we're here, where we're going, what's wrong, how to live. Those are all big questions that we individually wrestle with. And the expectation for the skeptic is that they have this pristine, over there on the left, you know, that they have this pristine, wonderful worldview: without God, I can live the way that I want. I can be the captain of my own ship. You know, I'm the courageous one. I'm the smart one. You know, I'm rationally superior. I've got it going on. Without God, I don't need that crutch. But yet, over time and experience, they begin, again, to see some of the emptiness, some of the conflicts within their own worldview. You know, Francis Schaeffer talks about that we are God's creation, who are living in God's world. And if we don't live in accordance with God, then attention can come. And there has to be, there's a dissonance, and we have to just in it ourselves have to resolve that. We have to problem solve. So Eric had certain things within his own atheism that he couldn't explain. So he began to have this dissonance.
But I just figured, well, right and wrong is just a matter of convention. And so if lying here might benefit me or not hurt somebody else's feelings, there's nothing objectively wrong with that. And I just felt like life was very meaningless. It was very kind of pointless and depressing. And I think that's probably where some of the drugs and distractions of hanging around the wrong people came from. And so, yeah, it was just a pretty grim outlook. And it was really hard to be consistent with that, because one moment, you know, you're saying there's no real right and wrong. But the next minute, if somebody wrongs you, you're like, hey, something bad has happened. There's been an injustice, you know, and it's like, okay, well, where does that idea come from? It's hard to be consistent and just go, well, I guess that's just my feelings. And so, yeah, it was mostly something that I kind of lived with, and maybe I didn't always see that inconsistency, but it was kind of like a stone in my shoe at times, because it just didn't seem to jibe with the way reality really is. And so that was a problem. I would say the other things that caused me to reconsider, was while I couldn't understand maybe where humans came from, and I told you that like science seemed to tell us, you know, where origins of people and all the life that we see seem to explain that, it was kind of hard to explain, you know, where did the universe come from? I mean, how is it just here for no reason at all and completely uncaused, and have this, you know, appearance of beauty and even purpose and design? How are all of my intuitions about all of these things and everybody else's intuitions about these things seemingly wrong? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so these things started to bother me, and eventually I sort of became more of like an agnostic, I guess, but I would lean towards maybe deism. I thought, well, maybe God created the universe, but he's not really involved. He's not really active in the universe. And so I began to become open.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess you could hear that. He was starting to try to make sense of his own worldview. Same thing with Pat, the one who left religion behind in order, you know, when science, the science rocks explanation gave a better...
For whatever reason, I was always haunted by the big philosophical questions for as long as I can remember. And I thought maybe I would get answers to them through a particular naturalistic avenue. And initially that seemed like I was going to. Like, you know, the sort of the scientism has got this, right? And that's what led me down that path. But the deeper I got into it, the more I realized, no, this is not adequate to handle reality. This is not adequate to explain the things that I need to be explained for me. And in fact, it seems... the deeper I go into this worldview, the more it has to kind of eliminate or explain away things that are so fundamental I don't think they could be coherently denied. Call them like a slew of Morian facts, if you will, like things like free will, consciousness. Consciousness was a big one for me. The moral landscape, the objective moral landscape, right? Moral duties and values and stuff like that. The more I kept going into this atheistic naturalistic paradigm, the more it seemed like I was being forced, unless I was willing to really contrive the worldview and hypothesis, the more I was being forced to say that these things aren't what they seem to be, right? That these things aren't real in the way that they sure seem to be real, right? They're illusions. I'm suffering under delusions or things like that. Maybe I'm not even real, right? Maybe I'm just like a bundle of particles, right? Stuff like that. And at some point, those tensions came to be too much that I realized, I don't know what the truth is. I've been trying to find it. I have no idea what the truth is. But this is definitely not it. this is definitely not it. I made a mistake and have set down the wrong path. And that's when I didn't become a theist, I didn't become religious immediately, but I at least sort of took a step back and told myself I need to take another look at things. I need to consider new perspectives.
Yeah, so he was, again, intellectually honest. And it takes some desire to seek the truth in order to go this path. And some people aren't there, but some people are. Ashley was another one of those. Religion was for stupid people. This was what opened the door for her.
I also really liked Christopher Hitchens, who he was, of course, one of the big new atheists at the time. And I really liked him, just thought he was so clever and so smart. And so he had a book coming out around that time called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And so I remember getting that book and thinking, like, this is going to be the key. Like, this book is going to really codify this belief system for me, and I'm going to be able to indisputably, you know, shut down anyone that I encounter. And I remember lying in my bed in my apartment reading it, and I read about half of it, and I just had this, like, cold, hollow, empty feeling. And I distinctly remember throwing the book down on the floor, and eventually it got, like, kicked under my bed. But I just felt like, if this is the truth, why does it feel so bad? Like, why does it feel so empty? Why does it feel like it's siphoning all of the mystery and magic out of the world? Because there was this very hard certainty in his writing and in the New Atheist writing. And it just felt like, it just made me feel so cold and bereft and hollow and empty. And that was really a cracking point for me, thinking, like, I don't know if I can abide in this worldview.
Interestingly, for Ashley, she did not move immediately towards God. She was looking for magic and mystery, and she went into mushrooms and psychedelics, and until that had a dead end as well. Carrie, her friend, was a Christian who lived down the street. And in the meantime of trying to pursue magic in all the wrong ways, Carrie was over here living a Christian life. And she lost her young daughter. And Ashley observed Carrie and the way that she handled that with such grace and dignity and peace. She saw something in Carrie, and eventually they started talking, and she found her way to Christ. So about a third of the people that I interviewed came to the conclusion that their own worldview, you know, wasn't logical, it wasn't livable, and that maybe God exists, maybe God matters. The second disruptor was, again, that crisis point, that unexpected crisis that interrupts life and causes questioning. We all know and have experienced that for the most part. The question is, when a crisis comes your way, do you have the kind of belief system or worldview that can help you cope or make sense of what is happening? Sometimes, you know, we don't have that, especially if we don't have God. Nikki Naphurst was a Jewish atheist living in Portland. She was surrounded by a lot of occultism, a lot of intellectualism. She enjoyed discussing ideas. She thought rationality and science held the answers. Science was her God that would cure religious insanity. That was her perspective. Not surprising in the Northwest. But she had a health crisis, and it was a very significant health crisis. And it's amazing how sobering that can be.
As my health got worse and worse, I did reach out for help, and I began to have my beliefs challenged in a way, because truth became very important. Like, truth, like, knowing what was true, what was actually true, became central to my life at that point. Like, you have to know, you have to be, if you're going to be honest, if that's like a characteristic in your life that you want to pursue, honesty, then you have to know what truth is in order to tell it. That's probably when that door opened for me, that I just really wanted to know what was true in order to speak it, because I wanted to have integrity in my life. So that was the first step that I took.
And of course, she was facing her own mortality. And that you really do want to know what's true at that point, right? So that was a crisis. There were many crises in my study, you know, from relational breakdown, divorce, death, all kinds of things that can cause people to become open. Sometimes, again, like I mentioned before, skeptics can be confronted with the truth of Christianity in a way that they did not expect it. They're confronted and challenged in an intellectual way, and they're often driven to show that Christianity is wrong. It opens them sometimes for the first time to the depth and riches of the Christian worldview that they did not think existed. Sometimes it comes through people we know. Like if you're a skeptic and then someone you know becomes a Christian, that can be an affront on many levels, emotionally and just what is this? What have they, you know, bought into? It could be someone you meet randomly. It could be a debate. It could be, you know, a book. There's all kinds of ways that we are confronted with Christianity. Listen to Daniel. Remember, he didn't care, to be honest, about Christianity until his grandparents became Christians.
Yeah, so when I was 19, my grandparents had become Christians at the time, and so when I went around their house, they would often talk to me about God, especially Jesus, and we would just talk, and I just, if I'm honest, I thought they were in a cult. I thought they were mad. But what kind of started it, I wasn't taking them seriously, and I would ask lots of questions, but, you know, looking back, I must have given it some thought, you know, in a way, because I did have objections and questions that, and so, you know, they would try their best to kind of give me sort of answers. You know, some were satisfying, some probably most were not. But what it did is it sort of stoked an interest to maybe think about some of these things a little bit more. I kind of thought that if he's going to keep talking about this stuff all the time, I should at least have a more informed criticism. And so it's really at that point when I started kind of taking those questions a bit more seriously, thinking about those bigger sort of questions and doing a little bit of sort of, you know, a bit of reading here and there, looking on stuff online, going to the library.
Yeah, so he doesn't really say it there, but he initially sought to disprove. And what's often the case is they will start to disprove, and then at some point in the journey, they will really want to know what's true, not just to disprove. And that's what happened with him. He's now a master's degree philosopher defending life. Peter was a Christian until he went to college. And he said, "I had sincere intellectual doubts and insincere motives." He wanted to live the way that he wanted to live, but he also had doubts. He lived with both of an atheist who had become a Christian and a Christian who had become an atheist. So they had some pretty lively discussions in their home. But he was a very strong advocate of Richard Dawkins, because Dawkins, you know, the new atheist, the prominent atheist, he always said, go where the evidence leads. But he became disconcerted when Dawkins wouldn't debate William Lane Craig, and this was in London. So he thought, if atheism held the answers, why won't he debate the prominent Christian philosopher? And so it took him down a journey towards Christian apologetics.
I think there were lots and lots of holes in the Christian belief that didn't make sense to me. There were things about the atheist view that seemed to make it a more comfortable default position. But I think that the real change started happening was when I discovered the Christian apologetics, and I mean the really good ones, the ones that were philosophically, academically trained. And the one that I think really did stand out the most was William Lane Craig of Reasonable Faith. There were all sorts of videos of him debating atheists and really putting up a very, very strong set of arguments. And then I would go to his website, I would read more of his material, start listening to his podcasting. And gradually I got the sense that, okay, if you really want evidence and you're meant to use reason and logic, it looks like he's using it. It was discovering the strength of the Christian academic apologetics. And then I started to perceive things differently, I think.
Yeah, so it's amazing, you know, when someone actually discovers, again, the breadth and depth of Christian thinkers who are solid, and it really is the best explanation for reality. The fourth way that people became open, again, this was a surprise for me, was some kind of spiritual experience. Sometimes that would come when the atheist would actually say, God, are you real? Kind of testing God, or actually from a real strong sense of, really do, just tell me if you're real. But sometimes it actually came when someone wasn't even looking for it. And of course, when you have a spiritual experience, if you believe that there nothing exists beyond the natural world, that there is no supernatural, what do you do with a spiritual experience when it comes? You have to make sense of it. And that happened to Mary Poplin. She was a university professor. She had no desire for God, no desire for an authority in her life. She was doing just fine. And then she had a dream.
I thought I was good as anybody else, right? Even though I was doing things that everybody else was doing. And so I kept trying to call myself good, right? But somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew that wasn't working. And then I had a dream at Thanksgiving, and that dream was really the turning point. I remembered every single detail. I looked up ahead, and we were all, this was a reception line, and we were all going to pass by Jesus. And when I got to Jesus and I looked at him, I knew who he was. And all of a sudden, I also knew who I was. And I was deeply embarrassed. I mean, I felt like I was just, you know, filled with sin and rottenness and all that. And so I couldn't look at Jesus anymore. And I fell down at his feet and I started to cry. And in the dream, then Jesus leans over and puts his hands on my shoulders. And when he touched me, I felt perfect peace. And then I woke up.
It was life-changing for her. She then went on a search to find this Jesus. The first person she went to was a colleague who was Islamic. And he pointed her towards the Quran. She read the Quran. It didn't seem to find the same Jesus that she had encountered. And ended up going and finding the Bible, reading that, and found Christ. She's since written books on worldview and Christian apologetics and comparative worldviews and things like that. Strong advocate for faith now. And finally, and I think this is really, really important for us to understand, the disarming nature of actually engaging with an authentic Christian, a genuine Christian who takes Christ seriously, who takes the Bible seriously, who takes their discipling seriously, who really have something different about them that's different than the negative stereotypes and caricatures that they had built in their mind as Christians being all bad and all evil and unintelligent. But when they encounter the real of Christ through you, they are disarmed suddenly, oftentimes. Again, because of the lack of exposure, many people haven't met a genuine Christian. The studies show that there's an intentional social distancing between believers and skeptics. And so, you know, there's oftentimes this us-them mentality, and it's easy to create a straw man only to break it down, you know, rather than to actually engage and see what someone is really like. And so oftentimes they haven't met a Christian, so it's easy to target the Christian. And you know, to be honest, there's been a lot of negative exposures. They have met a Christian or have gone to church or had a bad church experience or had a bad experience with religious people. So there's that. But when they meet someone, you know, that, again, is a genuine Christ follower that breaks down those stereotypes, it can make a difference. With Nikki, remember, she was confronting her own mortality. She had been in an AA meeting group where she met a woman named Mary. And let's listen to the difference that Mary made in her life.
Her name is Mary. She's my little angel. I came in one day just this shaking, and she grabbed onto my hand and has not let go. We called her Bible Thumping Mary. And here's this atheist and this Bible thumper, and we became friends. I really believe that Jesus was probably fictional, probably completely fictional. And so when Mary started talking to me about her Jesus and how much she loved him, I thought, oh my gosh, this lady's nuts. But I really like her. But she would tell me she's praying for me, and she's got her church praying for me. And I didn't know what to make of that. I would just tell her, please don't pray for me. That's dumb. The things she would say were true, and like morally true, emotionally true, and I didn't know what to do with that. That was really challenging. I didn't know it was God, but my heart was open. Like, love was a very important virtue to me, because I needed that connection. I hit a point where I was so desperate in my life that I was just going to choose good people. And Mary was good, and she was loving, and she showed up, and she would, I mean, that's what spoke to me. I was just laying in bed being sick, and so I needed someone like Mary to just kind of love me, and that's really what spoke. That's what did it.
It's amazing the power of love in someone's life. Not long after that, she actually had an encounter with Christ, where there was this big golden light and a symbol of the cross and Jesus singing over her. She said the next morning she started speaking scripture that she had never even read. So she became a passionate follower of Christ all through, you know, the way that God used Mary in her life. So there are these different disruptive catalysts, you know, longings, crises, challenges, and, you know, divine encounters and disarming experiences. But once someone becomes open, that's the key. Once someone becomes open through a catalyst, then they go on a quest to really determine what is true. But as with most of these, when they went on a quest, they actually found what, you know, we all know, which is God is real and true and good and relevant. For Mike, you know, he was a very moral guy, atheist, in the army in Australia, and it really bothered him that some of his buddies would not treat women well when they would go out at night. And you know, he had this real strong sense of morality. He just didn't know how to ground it. He explains how that kind of helped draw him to the need for God.
You know, whether you push an old lady in front of a bus or help her across the road, you could argue that in an atheist universe, these actions are meaningless. They have no objective or real moral quality. They're just things we project onto them, and what you project onto them is no more authoritative than what someone else might project onto them. So I knew that I lived in a morally meaningless universe. The problem was I couldn't live without moral meaning, and I knew some things were absolutely wrong, some things were evil, but I did not have a metaphysic that could support that kind of ethic. So when I became a Christian, it was suddenly the lights tricked on, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is the reason why I believe evil exists. This is the reason why I believe in good. This is why people look up the stars and kind of, you know, wonder about things divine or heavenly. A whole bunch of things made sense.
It's amazing. When you can make sense of your world, it's a good thing. And Jim, we haven't met him either, but I love the way that he describes how everything came together, became sensible once he understood who God was.
The thing that made most sense of what I observed in the world around me and what my experience of life was, the thing that made most sense about that was that there was a God, that he does exist, that we are creative beings, that we are immaterial minds and not just physical brains, that the universe hasn't existed for eternity and didn't just pop into existence by magic, but had a beginning, and that there is a meaning to life that has been given to us externally by a God who has given life meaning in the first place and given us meaning.
So again, you know, it's amazing what we sometimes take for granted as Christians when those who don't have God, what they struggle with. it, you know, and that personal struggle for, you know, that's epidemic in our culture today, searching for meaning, searching for identity, searching for belonging, all of those things. It's those personal things that seem to drive the openness more than a rational argument, more than reasons and facts. In fact, 80% of those in my study were open more for personal reasons. They found something about Christianity that was good or attractive. And then they were willing to go on a truth-seeking search. Now, some of them actually, the minority, were very, very intellectually driven all throughout. But more often than not, it was something attractive. As Blaise said, you know, make religion attractive, make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. He knew what I found in my research, you know, a couple or a few hundred years ago. And of course, I really want to emphasize that the endpoint, the source of truth, of life, of love, you know, is Jesus. He is the endpoint. He is the point of everything, and it's only in and through Christ that we can have what we have, and we enjoy him. Now, at the end of every interview and at the end of every podcast, I ask each person, as a former skeptic or as a former atheist, how would you best counsel us as Christians as to how to engage with those who are skeptical or who don't believe? And I think his answer is really pretty wonderful, so I wanted to include that.
I would say definitely prepare. Again, in order to do evangelism, you really do need to have some basic understanding of apologetics. There are so many good resources out there on YouTube, podcast, books, that there's really just no excuse anymore not to be trained. But also, reach out. I had one person hand me a track, and I had one high school teacher, just be kind of a good character witness. And that was about the most interaction I had with Christians that I'm aware of. Maybe people were praying for me behind the scenes, and I definitely wouldn't understate the importance of that. So possibly that had some effect, but My sometimes I just think back and I'm like, I know there were Christians at my school. Why didn't any of them come talk to me? Mm-hmm. And so, do something, say something. But too many Christians are so tight-lipped and just don't even think about it and are so oblivious that there really is a world around you of people who, like me at that time, felt pretty hopeless and, you know, that there wasn't much meaning to life. And if somebody who, an intelligent, thoughtful Christian came by and talked to me sooner, maybe I wouldn't have wasted as much time as I did. I don't know. So don't be afraid to reach out. And so there's the boldness aspect and, of course, prayer, the spiritual aspect, and then just the mental preparation aspect of being prepared in apologetics. Mm.
Again, just to reiterate, prayer, prayer, prayer. This is, again, God is the one who changes hearts. God is real, and God intercedes, and God interacts, and we depend on him. But prayer played a prominent part in many people's journeys. They would look back and say, I know so-and-so was praying for me. I knew my grandparents were praying for me. You know, those kinds of things. It's just critically important, especially heard that a lot in the spouse and unbeliever. A lot of prayer. Presence. Again, the importance of being an embodied witness of Christ in people's lives so that we can break down those stereotypes, so that they can see that Christians are normal people. That we're not all of those negative things that the world wants to say that we are. Being present, play the long game, as someone says, so that when those disruptions, when the moments of openness, when the crisis comes, when the longings surface, that you're there, that you're the neighbor, you know, you're the one who's been in their life, that they can look at and see a difference and be a safe place to come and be a point of attraction. You know, you are that sweet aroma when someone's willing to see you for who you are. And, of course, being prepared, like you said, it's so that when the hard questions do come, if you don't know the answers, at least you know the resources or how to ask good questions or those kinds of things. And, of course, one said, just be relationally patient because you, again, have to play the long game. You don't know when those moments of disruption are going to occur, but your presence and your patience, not pushiness, but patience, is very key, because oftentimes people who are angry or resistant or apathetic don't like to be pushed. Now, certainly there were some who rose to a challenge. That's not to say that doesn't happen. And engaging in meaningful question asking can make a difference, but being patient and play the long game, because some of these people, it took decades. And you'd never think that they would come to Christ, but there they are, you know. There they are. And the most encouraging thing I think I saw in my study is that 82% of these former atheists had some engagement or interaction with a Christian that made a difference. It wasn't that we were just, you know, or, you know, over there and they're over here and, you know, never the twain shall meet, but there were some active engagement. So that really is a calling for us, because the Lord can really use you and your lives to affect the lives of others. Again, this is just my podcast where former atheists and skeptics tell their stories and give advice. A QR code if you want to link to it. I think we've got 3 minutes. I don't know if we just want to close in prayer. If you want to come and ask me questions after, I'm more than happy to stay and talk with anybody. I know our time is short. I think we'll just close in prayer. And then we'll be done. It's just, again, I'm so thankful to have had this opportunity, and I would love to just talk with any of you if you have anything you'd like to say or a question to ask, but let's close. Father, you are a good father, and you love everyone, those who are far away, those who are near. You don't wish for anyone to perish. You wish for all to come to a place of eternal life, to know you, to know life abundant, to know it fully. We know that you have us in this generation, in this moment, and we want to fulfill your purposes for us individually in this time, in this moment, with the people that you've placed in our lives. I pray, Lord, as Eric said, that we would be bold in our faith, that we would be loving like Mary, like, that we would be prepared like Peter to give an answer, that we would just be present. Lord, we pray for your Holy Spirit's guidance and empowerment. We pray for boldness, for courage. We pray that you would enrich all of our speaking and all of our knowledge so that you could make us ambassadors full of salt and light, that you would use us for your purposes and to help bring others to the kingdom, to your kingdom, to Jesus. And we pray that he would be glorified through our lives and in this moment. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Thank you. I think we're done. You're dismissed.